the opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this April 15th, 2020 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and always available via podcast. We're once again on iTunes. We are always on Stitcher and other podcast platforms under Writers on Writing. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, how they're working and focusing and thinking during these interesting quarantine days. I recorded this interview from my home office, which had some bumps in internet connectivity on my end. Much of my audio is a little garbled, but my guest for the hour, Randy Kraft, comes in loud and clear. Randy is a novelist, journalist, and short story writer. The bulk of her career was spent writing for newspapers and magazines. She still writes book reviews at OC Book Blog for OC Insight. Her two previous novels, Colors of the Wheel and Signs of Life, were published in 2014 and 2016. Rational Women is her latest. It's a collection of 11 short stories, and it will drive much of our discussion this morning. Randy, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Thank you. It's great to have you. So I'll start by saying that you seem like one of those writers who is doing the most of your quarantine time. And I don't know if that's an illusion or that's reality, but I'd love just to start off by you telling us a little bit about how you're kind of managing this strange time we're living through and sort of impact it's had on your writing life and your literary life, sort of positively or negatively.
I'm not sure managing is really the best word, but I am navigating as best as I can. I write every day as a rule. I had planned to take a break between Rational Women and the next novel, maybe to organize my thoughts or mostly to just read, which I do a lot of also. But I have short stories in my brain after spending 4 years in the writing of this book. So I find myself, because I'm home so much, writing a couple of short stories that I'm still working on and trying to write every day, 3-4 hours a day, which I always do, except that I write at a cafe, one of a few different cafes around Southern California. So, and I like that because writing is such a solitary act, but I like the sense of humanity around me. And I really miss that. And I'm finding, oddly enough, it's a little harder to concentrate at my little desk at home.
That's funny.
But so I think I'm reading more than writing, but that's how I'm doing it. But I'm back. I'm on it. I'm writing. We'll see where it goes.
Do you structure the day pretty rigorously where you have your time and that's, you know, that's the devoted time? Or it sounds like you're not a person who sits around and waits for inspiration to strike.
I do not. I do not. And I haven't, especially since I started working freelance for many, many years. The writing was put aside because I was making a living and raising children. And when I went to more of a part-time and freelance writing arrangement, I sort of split the day. Half the day was for the deadline, the paying gigs, and the other half of the day was for fiction. And I still tend to do that, even though I'm now retired from the other, mostly, except for the book reviews for OC Insight. So I still kind of have that routine of writing 3 or 4 hours a day. I modeled that after Somerset Maugham, who was an inspiration to me at a very young age, and he wrote every day of his life for 60 years, I think, every morning from 8 a.m. until noon, and then he stopped. And he was very prolific, as you may know. And I just thought, well, this makes sense. Sit down. It's a job. Work at it. And I do. And I find inspiration when I'm in front of the screen or have a journal in my hand.
Do you find sort of the external world encroaching on your fiction now? Like, are you you know, writing sort of quarantine sort of stories, or do you kind of keep it separate?
Yeah, no, I feel the need to keep that separate. It's hard enough to digest as it is without letting it permeate too much of your life, I think. So, and I'm very disciplined about keeping news in small doses because otherwise it's too easy to be consumed by it or go mad. So right. I'm trying to keep it out of the work. Just it's out there and I'm here. And then when I break, I go back into the real world and see what's going on.
I also feel like it takes a little bit of time for, you know, the stuff to percolate and digest. Maybe, you know, there's a little bit been mentioning in some of your work later on. And maybe that came years after it happened.
That's a good question, because in my second novel, Signs of Life, which published, as you said, in 2016, although I had worked on it early in the millennium and then moved away from it and came back to it. But there's a section of that that takes place during 9/11.
Yeah.
And so that was many years later. So I think it does percolate up, maybe. But I suspect there's going to be a plethora of writings of all types about this pandemic and its effect on the world. And so, you know, there will be no shortage of writing on this subject. I think I might stay away from it.
There already is. Yeah, there already is.
Oh, yeah, it's already starting, of course. And there already was the prescient writings.
Right, right, right. So let's talk a little bit about your decision to go from the novel form. So you had two novels out three or four years ago, the short story form, because, you know, there always seems to be this pressure for writers to focus on the novel. And I really like this move from the novel to the short story. So talk a little bit about that decision.
It often goes the other way around, isn't it? A lot of people start with short stories and then move into longer fiction. I've always loved short stories. I've always read them. I always have some by the bedside. I think they're the most perfect fictional form, but I think they're also very difficult to write. And they've always been especially difficult for me. For some reason, they always felt to me. I wrote many of them over the years. I wrote a lot of them in graduate school. I always seemed to feel like they were really segments or chapters of a larger story. Mm-hmm. And in fact, both novels, well, the first novel, Colors of the Wheel, is told in story-like segments and started with a short story that I'd written in graduate school. And then Signs of Life is a much more traditional novel, but it also, the character in that book began in a story. So stories are always at the root somehow for me. But I've often said, too often said aloud, oh, I'm just not really good at short stories. And I really believe that. I came to believe that. And I heard myself say that once too often. And I said it actually at a launch event for Signs of Life 4 years ago. And I thought, you know, aren't you tired of saying that you're not good at this? Why don't you just get better at it? So I decided to devote a year, just a year, I thought, to writing stories, just to write them. I had no intentions of publishing a collection. I just had nothing in mind but to get back into the form and try my hand. And 3 years later, I had written 15 of them, and I thought they were better. So I started submitting them to literary magazines to validate, and was able to publish several. And then I also, early in the process, began to realize a theme had emerged, this theme of supposedly modern, rational, accomplished women of one form or the other who struggle with passion, and sometimes are either too rational or allow passion to undo them. And so I had a theme, and then I had a collection.
I love that you said that there was sort of the story that you told yourself about what you do and what you couldn't do. And I find that is the crux of what stands in so many writers' way, so many people's way in general, of telling yourself this story of who you are, what you can do, what you can't do, and allowing that to really guide, you know, either your career or your life choice or whatever. So that's helpful.
Yeah, I think it's a huge obstacle for a lot of people. And I've always been an avid reader, and I like to think of really quality material. And I remember once I was while I was in graduate school, I was in a summer conference, and there were some wonderful writers speaking, and I happened to be sitting at lunch with one of them. And I mentioned the fact that there's just so many great writers out there. Does the world need another one? I mean, I'll never be as good as any of these people that I read. And I feel that often. And she said to me, listen, so there's always going to be somebody better than you. What difference does it make? You just have to be better than you think you are. Right. And I never forgot that.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
And that's another internal monologue that I think a lot of writers have, which is, why am I doing this? What's the, you know, what's the point? That's really helpful.
Right.
So let's dive into the collection. You started to introduce it a little bit, and I'd like you to talk about it more. You also already a couple of questions, which is how long working on this, which really sounds like a fairly compressed period of time. So the stories were written in sort of a 3 to 4 year period. Is that right?
Most of it, yeah, they were all written within a 3 year period. And then I spent last year both submitting and also, you know, revising and fine tuning, okay. Although I edit as I go, but lots of intensive editing during that period.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. No, you go.
I was going to say, did that theme come ahead of the stories, or did that emerge kind of, you know,
no.
after
Mm-mm.
the, okay. Okay.
No, I started, so the first story I wrote, which is actually the last story in the collection, I had was visiting some friends in London, and we went over to Paris. And I was saying to this friend who had lived in Paris, it had been so many years since I'd been there, I must never let so much time go again before I go to Paris, because this, you know, it's such a grand city, and no matter how much it changes, it stays the same. And on the way, after I left Paris, I was on the train, actually, to Brussels. And I thought, who couldn't like Paris? And then I thought, well, wait, wouldn't that be an interesting thing to explore? Who wouldn't like Paris? And why would he or she be there? And I came home and began to write that story. And that character, who was actually difficult because she's sort of a flat affect, but she wasn't boring. She wasn't the least bit boring. And I didn't want her to be boring, but she had constructed a very tight life, very narrow, repressed life for herself to keep herself safe. And she only went to Paris to fulfill the wish of a dying mother. And then something happened to her there, not to revolutionize her life, but maybe offer her the sense that there were other options out there. And she saw a glimpse of life beyond this very narrow life that she had constructed. So that was the first story. And then I wrote a story about and I'll never be quite sure where this came from, but a teacher in a town very similar to Dana Point, suffers from an abandonment complex, actually, and she's overly devoted to her children because that's all she has. And she too had structured this life that was very, in her mind, rational, repressing these deep emotions that she had felt until she begins to unravel, actually. And so there were two, and a third one came along, and I began to see that there was something similar to these women. They were very different in different stages of their lives and in different places, and what happened to them was all different. But there was this similarity that they very consciously and pragmatically had created a life for themselves which denied some of their true passions. And the concept was born.
I love it. And so at what point there are 11 stories, and kind of at what point was it kind of after the second one that idea was born? We're writing to that, or kind of.
I was really. It was really after the third, and then yeah, I didn't want to lock myself in to anything,
yeah.
So I tried not to write to anything, but as each story happened, I just saw that okay, this is what you're writing about.
Yeah.
So there were 15 in total that I wrote, and there were a couple of them that didn't fit the theme, so they didn't make it into the collection. And then a couple of others that just never quite hit the mark, you know. So it ended up with 11 that fit, and that seemed good enough to me to make a collection.
I love it. I love it. My guest this morning is Randy Kraft, the book Rational what we're talking about. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So we've never really talked about this, but I'd love to hear about your relationship, because they're obviously all women, and kind of your relationship with feminism and your relationship with women. By women, I mean other women or specific women. I mean the gender of women.
Mm-hmm.
And because you, you know, you're a mother of grown women, and you're a daughter, and you're a partner, and you've had a number of careers. You know, I feel like you've looked at these various roles of women from a number of angles and over different periods of time. So I just kind of love to hear your sort of global thoughts about feminism and your perspective on that, and kind of if these feel were born out of ideas about feminism or ideas about women. Kind of unpack your relationship with that's a big question, isn't it?
It's a big question, but there are a few simple answers, I think. One is, I came into the workplace in 1970, so I arrived as the modern feminist movement began. Mm-hmm. And so it's an integral part of my life. But also, even before that, my mother, I'm an only child, and my mother, who was a high school graduate, not very well-educated human being, but an avid reader, and she didn't use the word feminism, but she was a staunch feminist. And so I grew up, and she tried to infuse in me always a sense of supreme independence, maybe even to a fault. And then I went into the workplace. I started by accident because I wanted to write, but you know, I couldn't afford to live. And I ended up in business and marketing and communications. And I did my writing there for a while before I went into journalism. But so I really arrived in this moment when things were changing, and I became part of it. And then I raised my daughters similarly. I encouraged them to be independent, to find themselves, to center themselves before they moved on into other worlds. And I also encouraged them not to marry too soon, not to have children too soon, to fulfill themselves, who they were. Unfortunately, they took me to my word. So it was very late in the game before grandchildren were delivered. But it is a part of me. I don't wake up every morning and think I'm a feminist. What am I going to do for feminism today? But I feel very strongly about these issues. There's no question that it infuses some of the writing. Yeah. I just don't see it as front and center, but it's there. It's underlying because it's still a very important issue, maybe never more so again, in the world that we're living in. And we have to be vigilant.
Right. I was just kind of interested in that question because so many of the women there are women at different stages of their life. There's, you know, a new mother, right. And there's older women, sexual women, sort of women who have lost touch with their sexuality. And so as I was thinking of you accessing each of these characters, I was wondering if you drew yourself back, not that any of them are autobiographical, but you drew yourself back to certain times of your life as a new mother, as a, you know, sort of woman exploring her sexuality
absolutely.
At the beginning. Yeah.
Me or the women I know. You know, and I don't write, and this is all fiction. There's nobody in there. If anything, there might be some composites, but there's nobody in there that I know per se. But you do write what you know, not your own life, but just the experiences and what you've seen and absorbed. And it's, so there's a lot of what I've observed. It's really a matter of observation, what I've seen in other people and what I've seen in myself as well. And I think it's impossible to write these sorts of stories, particularly about women, I have wonderful women friends, So, you know, you draw on all of that.
Right. You're wonderful at describing rooms. I went back to look at so many of these stories for your descriptions of furniture and space and architecture and, you know, what you're looking at out the window, and your sense of place is really great. And that's something I forget about in my own writing, to sort of, you know, I think it's because I can't see it so well myself, and so I sort of forget to describe it. But that was a great lesson.
It's funny. That's a real challenge, though, because on the one hand, you always want the reader, particularly of short stories, I think, to be somewhat of a voyeur. So they're right in there with you. You want them to see what the character sees, as long as it fits. You know, there are some stories where they are, it doesn't matter quite as much. So it's a challenge to the craft to know when to describe the setting in more detail or less. And that was always a challenge for me. Yeah, it's a real challenge.
Yeah, good point. Good point. And there are, and the stories are set, I guess, to that point, kind of all over the place. There are a few in Europe. There, right. You know, they're in the mm-hmm. States. And I'm always curious if writers, if it's easier for you to access places when you're physically in them, or if you have to kind of be away from them to, you know, reflect on them and see them at a distance. You know what I mean?
I think, yeah, I do. I think it's really important. I think authenticity is extremely important. So if you're going to set something in a place, you either have had some time there or experience there, or whether it's in your memory or present. And you have to know it well enough to really, especially in a short story where you don't want to go too far with the descriptions, to quickly pull out the descriptions that really matter. Yeah. And so I started that story in Paris right after I was there. There's a story in there that takes place in Lucerne, which I started while I was still that night. The last night I was there at a restaurant, I started that story there so that I was. But mostly I when I go places, I do take lots of notes. There's a story in there that, you know, about a New York woman who's at traffic court.
Yeah.
And that story happened because, oh my God, it's got to be 20 years ago. I went to traffic court and it took so long to be called on the docket that I just sat there taking notes about everyone sitting there and what I saw and what I smelled and the light. And I just, you know, I just wrote everything down about the place I was in. And when I was going through old journals in the process of writing stories, I came to that. And I thought, oh, there's got to be a story here.
Great.
And so it wasn't even in my memory, wasn't conscious, but there it was. And there was so much in it that I thought, oh, this is perfect. There's got to be a story in all of this. So I think it's terribly important to have spent some time in a place or take good notes and make it real.
So you are a writer who takes a notebook sort of every you go and
everywhere.
Okay. Are you one of those who
sits in Starbucks?
I have a
notebook. I have a what?
I said, are you one of those who sits in Starbucks and then, you know, transcribes people's conversations behind you? I do that.
I refuse to answer on the grounds that they incriminate me. Not Starbucks, but yeah, I have done that. I have done that also. I've done a lot of character descriptions of people. You see an interesting person and you just want to sit down and make a note of what makes them interesting looking in some way. So I do a lot of that. I always have a notebook in my bag. I have a notebook in the car. I use an online note taking system. I keep a notebook by my bed because I learned many years ago that you wake up in the morning sometimes with the greatest ideas, or you wake up in the middle of the night and then by the time you've had your tea or coffee, whatever, they're gone.
Right.
So they have to be written down right away. So I keep a notebook by the bed too. If I wake up with an idea, I write it down immediately.
I just found these really cool.
Get them, we must all know.
Oh yeah, well, yes. True. No, I just found these new pens that if you click the top of it once, the light comes on just where the tip of the pen hits the paper, so you can write
right
in bed without. I love that. I don't know
perfect
why it took me so long to for those, but yeah, it was a brilliant discovery.
Perfect.
My guest this morning is Randy Kraft. The book we are talking about is Rational Women, and you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.1 Irvine. So I would love, well, actually, before we dive into this next question, I really admire you, not only your courage, but your ability to sort of head on into conversations about race and racism and cultural appropriation in a few of these stories. Mm-hmm. Most obviously a white writer, but subtextually, I think A Righteous Woman also did that. Maybe a few others. Obviously, you're not that. And you came at from the perspective of a white woman with the acknowledgement of I don't know what you would say, frustration or at being kind of locked out of the discussion of race. And before we dive to some of these stories more substantially, I'd love to sort of generally talk about sort of this interest you have in race, racial discussions and the conversation and kind of where the white writer fits into that.
Yeah, that story, by the way, was probably as close to personal as any of them, because I had written a book about race. And so I imagined, and I had sent it to a couple of Black critics who did not respond at all. So I imagined, well, what if somebody did and I was able to meet with them, but then they were dismissive? What would that look like? So that's how that story happened. I talk in that story about when I was a young girl. I have an aunt who lived in Virginia, and we used to go down there every summer, and it was still a very Jim Crow period. And I became conscious of these divides, the bathroom doors white and colored and other things, the great divides. And my mother was outraged by that. And she kind of passed on that outrage to me, but I always remembered it. But at the same time, I understand that for a lot of people, it's not seen as my battle. And my heart aches for it, and I'm outraged, and I'm often angry about it. And I try to stand up whenever I can, but I also understand it isn't my battle. And so I am aware of that. And I didn't consciously set out to put something about race in different stories, only where they were in context. If you're in a New York traffic court, there's going to be a lot of Black and brown people. And this particular character, who saw herself as so righteous, at least had the heart to express that. Mm-hmm. But despite some of her other sins, but it is, I do feel, I say in a white writer, and I believe this, that it's white people who have to step up. And so while it's not my battle, I'm not going to ignore it in any way. And when possible, I will step up, because I think we have to, because the divide is still insane and ridiculous in this country.
The interesting thing I thought about A Righteous Woman, which is the traffic court story, mm-hmm. and I don't want to give too much away about it, but she does make the observation of a lot of brown faces.
Right.
And that because of her position as a woman, she was probably enjoying a certain degree of protection from her right. sins that others mm-hmm. perhaps would not have enjoyed. Right. So,
that's what she thought.
Yeah. So it was, I feel like there are a lot of writers, particularly in the last couple of years, since cultural appropriation has become a, hot topic in the literary world and who has the right to write.
Lionel Shriver, the British writer, wrote about it a few years ago intensively, and it really fueled the fury. And there's been a lot of different writings about it. Zadie Smith wrote a magnificent essay last year in which she actually said a lot of things that I said in the story. She said them especially well. And then this American Dirt thing happened, and it went a kind of ballistic. So it's painful that the divide spreads so wide, including into literature, that people are we only allowed to write about our own experiences now? I mean, it gets a little crazy.
Yeah.
It gets a little crazy. So I don't think I don't really believe it to be cultural appropriation. I believe it's a form of cultural connection, actually.
Right. Right. Well, and I guess it comes down to how it's done, right? As opposed to just mm-hmm. doing it and
right.
it's done. Yeah.
Right.
So I would love to just take a couple of these stories, and you can choose them or I can choose them, whichever you prefer, and just kind of, I always call it dissecting them, but I think it's useful for writers to see, especially new writers, to see what a story goes through to, you know, from original conception to completion. And I think a lot of people, especially when they're encountering short stories, don't realize exactly how many revisions a lot of these often go through. So
I'll tell you one, you pick one and I'll pick one, because the one I'd love to talk about is The Chemistry Professor's Wife, because that went through fairly vast changes.
Oh, okay. All right. Do you want to do that first?
And then
do you want...
you can take another one. Sure.
Okay.
Whatever you like.
Let's do it. So this was written kind of when in the process, The Chemistry Professor's Wife. It's the second story in the collection.
It was the third or fourth story that I wrote.
Okay.
However, when I wrote it in third person because it wouldn't work in first person, because the chemistry professor's wife was suffering from a sort of lack of awareness and he wasn't the right voice. So I wrote it in third person, and a lot of it is there. That's there now. A lot of the story, it just didn't work. It didn't have the punch I felt it needed to have. Something wasn't working. I couldn't figure out what it was. I kept revising and altering and resequencing and I don't want to give too much away, but this story is a little strange to begin with because it has to do with a woman who's very attached to an inanimate object, a heating pad, that she's had since childhood. And when the heating pad finally becomes dysfunctional after 30 or 40 years, she kind of loses it. And she happens to be in a marriage that she probably shouldn't be in, but she's rationalized her way into that marriage. So it's an odd premise, but I really felt it had a good story. It had merit and it wasn't working. And finally I put it down, and I'll do this period. I put them all down periodically to go away from them, come back and see what I might've missed or what's too much or too little. Yeah. But that one I put aside thinking maybe this story is just not going to work, and they're not all going to work, and you can't always force it. And months later, I honestly did not remember what I was reading, but I was reminded of some of the really wonderful, mostly novels, but that have been told in a first person voice, a narration though by a secondary character. You mm-hmm. think about Gatsby, you know, Nick telling that story, the wonderful, charming Billy, that, you know, was told by Billy's best friend's daughter, actually. Alice McDermott. And one of my favorite books, Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge, which is actually told by a character who's supposed to be Somerset Maugham, who has these extraordinary observational powers, and he can tell the story. And I thought that's what I need here. I need a secondary character who cares about her, this chemistry professor's wife, and sees what's going on, and maybe even becomes the facilitator for the change in her life. And I introduced this teaching assistant, this tenure track junior professor who also works at the library and meets the wife at the library and kind of falls for her. And then it all came into place. It all began to work. And it was a wonderful learning experience for me, because sometimes it's, you know, obviously voice is terribly important in all literature. But sometimes it is the absolute linchpin for a short story. Who's
yes.
telling it, and what do they have to do with these characters, and why does it matter? So that was a wonderful experience for me, because then when it came to life, I think it really came to life.
Yes, 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 yes. How did that story even start? Did it start with a bad marriage? Start with one of these characters? Start with
no,
the heating
pad? No, it started
pad?
With a dead heating pad. Yes, it started with a dead heating pad. I kid you not. I had my mother's heating pad all of my life, and I had a lot of earaches and respiratory issues when I was a child, and they would put drops in my ear, and I have to lay down on the heating pad, and and stay very still. It was very meditative. Nobody used that word then, but it was very meditative and very soothing. And I always had this sense of this one, very few things in life that can bring you instant comfort. And yes. It did. And then it died. And I was bereft. And I remember saying to myself, "You are bereft over an inanimate object. What is wrong with you?" But I remembered that. You know, you're talking about things you remember. I remembered that. And I thought, you know, these things in our lives, they're not just a thing. They carry with them memory and connection and heart and all sorts of things. And when they're gone, they have to be mourned. And so I began to just think about what character might be mourning, but also what she might have to learn to disconnect from as she disconnects from the heating pad. So that's how that story came about.
So
it's too ridiculous, I know. But
it's so irrational. Right. Yeah, it's so irrational.
So irrational. Completely.
How much do you know about these women that never makes it to the page? Like, do you imagine, you know, really full kind of novelistic sort of lives for these women? Or do you kind of what you know about them ends up making it into the...
No, I think I have to know everything about them. I have to know their entire backstory and sometimes maybe even what might be ahead, because then you step into their lives in a moment. And that's the beauty of short stories, that sense of immediacy, that you're just here now. Sometimes, of course, short stories do cover a lot of territory, but as a rule, it's a kind of narrow canvas. But they're not going to be real or feel real, I don't think. And their motives won't be clear, at least in the writing, if I don't know everything about them.
Right.
So I do character studies. Either I write them down or they're in my head. And so, you know, I know what color their nail polish is or if they wear any and what their, you know, habits are.
I mean, that was sort of my imagining, is that these stories feel like you've known these people before they walked onto the page and after they leave the page. And so you, you imagine that the writer has to know way more than way, you know.
And I like to include some flashbacking in my stories too, if I think it's appropriate, so that the reader will also get to know a little bit more about them.
Right.
But not too much. Obviously, it's not a novel. But...
Now, any of these characters kind of haven't left alone, and if you wonder if some of them to a novel later on down the road?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I think they are where they belong.
Okay.
But I reserve the right to change my mind.
Sure. Sure, sure. I would love to talk about the you never know. You never know. Mm-hmm. The Disbelieving Daughter is a story about a woman who, her mother, who has been dead quite a time, never got the burial that they all imagined she had, that she's
Right.
She's still lingering in the...
She was stuck in cold storage. Yeah.
Stuck in cold, right. And so many things that kind of unraveled out of that story for me. And so I there's one that we could dissect also. I would love to do that one, sort of where the idea came from and how she unfolded over time as you were writing about her.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because honestly, I don't know where that story came from, except this happened a long time ago, like 15 years ago, but a friend of mine's father passed away. And in this story, this is a Jewish character. And in the Jewish religion, people have to be buried very quickly, like, you know, within 48 or 72 hours tops, and not on the Sabbath. And so they rush to burial, and they're always buried, because anything else is really not permitted. And this friend of mine's father had died, and it was winter, and they couldn't bury him. And they had to... Now, he was in the vault for a couple of weeks, but some of her family members were bereft. I mean, I keep using that word, but they were really upset, because this is not the way it's supposed to be done. But you couldn't dig the earth. And I remembered that, you know, it just didn't at the time seem to me to be a story, but I remembered how upset people were by that. And I think I sat down, I wanted to write a story about a woman who just couldn't find her center. She was accomplished, a successful businesswoman. She had been married, but unsuccessfully. She's had quite promiscuous, and she's the other side of that coin. She allows her passions to kind of make choices for her that have not been working well for her. And but I didn't know how to sort of enter that story, and what was the story. I mean, you know, Vivian Gornick, who I have to be reading again right now, my love, she wrote that glorious book called The Situation and the Story. You know, and there's a situation, but the situation is not a story. So in this case, this was a situation. What's the story? What's going to happen that makes it an interesting story? And somehow this character was born, that she came home from a run. She discovered her mother had been buried, and it had been a really long time. And she realized that her mother in some way might have been watching her destroy her mother's cherished values and kind of wreck her life, and how painful this was for her, and how was she gonna make it right? And it became a story.
How many revisions did that go through?
Hundreds, I think. I do an excessive amount of revising. In fact, I will tell you, I kept writing the stories individually, and then I think when after I had 10 or 11, I put them into one file as a collection, and began to decide what sequence they would be in, and so on. And that was quite a while ago, a couple of years. And every time I change anything, I mean even one word, but every time I change it, I save it again to the cloud. And the cloud always tells me what version it is. And before I published, it was up to version 116. And that doesn't include all the versions of the individual stories. So I'm a revisionist. I'm kind of a maniac editor. And that story particularly, it's funny you ask, because that story particularly, because there were a number of moving parts. She had a brother, and she had an ex-husband and her mother and lots of things going on, and this guy she was dealing with at the cemetery, and a rabbi. And so there were a lot of moving parts and people and more characters than usual in the stories. And so it went through many, many revisions. It was also the second story that was published last year in a journal called the Jewish Literary Journal. And so I was pleased that it was done. I said, okay, it's being published now. You need to stop.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because some of the stories that you've had published were under different names. And it struck me that even after they're published, you're still tinkering around with, I don't know if you're tinkering around with the content, but you're tinkering around with the names and the titles.
Well, no, the names, after I realized I had a collection, somewhere about halfway through that, I realized that I wanted to name each of the stories for the rational woman, who she was, the so-called rational woman in some cases.
Gotcha. Okay.
And so I named the story for that woman. But when I went to publish them elsewhere, that didn't make as much sense. It needed a more literary name. So right. I gave it the name I would have given it if it was just a story I was, you know, going to publish anywhere. So that's why they were in different names.
I was going to say, you know, titles are so tricky, and I think that's one of the hardest parts for short story writers, is you have to come up with 12 of them, you know, 15 of them, as opposed to just one for a book.
Right.
But titles have to do a lot of work. You know, they have to do subtextual work. Yeah. They have to, I don't know, bring some element to the story that maybe isn't in it already, to bring some new level of understanding to it. They're very hard.
It can be, yes.
Yeah. And I'm glad you said you kind of renamed these with the whole structure of the collection itself in mind. Now that I'm reviewing them again, I'm like, that all makes sense. That all makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you often find the title in the story itself, or tell me a little bit? I mean, I know these are kind of untitled to fit the question, but in general, when you're looking for titles that work, do you kind of have tips and tricks of knowing a title that's going to serve the story well?
I don't know if I have any tips per se, but I will say that it's a very good exercise, and I have taught story writing workshops, and I always advise the students, you need to know what the story is about, and we do not mean the plot line. We do not mean the plot line or the situation. What's it really about? And then a name will come to you that evokes what that's about. So in that story, it was Rest in Peace, because her mother wasn't resting in peace, but neither was she.
Right.
And there was a story in the book, it's called The Jaded Journalist. Mm-hmm. And it's about a journalist who has really missed a story, a longtime journalist who's lost her edge, and she's missed a story of someone in town who's dealing with a very difficult situation, and she's filled with regret and angst over this. But the woman she was writing about is a dance teacher. And it has to do with a dance teacher and one of her kids. And so it came clear to me that the story should be called Pas de Deux, because it was these two characters. So, but in the book, it's really more about the journalist who's telling the story. So if you think about what's this story really about, I think a title comes out of it, or sometimes a title just comes out of something that you've written or something in the dialogue.
Right. I want to go back to something you said earlier, because I think it bears repeating, and that is the situation versus the story versus the plot. Mm. And I don't know if the situation or plot are more on par with each other, but I do think that's a trap that a lot of writers fall into, that, this kind of interesting thing happened to me and that a story makes, which is not true.
No, it makes for an essay, maybe,
right,
or some sort of expository writing, if you want to describe a situation. But a story, has to have some other meaning, some greater meaning. And have obviously all the other literary qualities to it. But the situation is just a situation, which is perfectly fine from a lot of the writing that's on the internet.
And do you feel when you're... I was just going to say, do you feel that when you're working on a story, the plot and the situation, is there sort of an order in your writerly of these things evolve? First, you have to have, a really strong character, and then the plot, and then from you come to understand as the writer what the story really is? Or do you often have ideas that this would make a good story, and so I'm going to construct the other elements around it to get that point?
Boy, that's a very good question, which I'm not sure I can answer, except to say that all of my writing, the fiction, begins with character for me.
Okay.
I'm a character-based writing. And from the character, then the character, once I understand the character, maybe the character is in a situation, but that's just the beginning of a story. And plot is really just the sequence of how things play out, And that's all plot really is. This happens, that happens. Whoops, that goes over here. This happens there. But the story has to do with, from that situation, what's going to evolve? How is this character going to change or not?
Yes.
Because this idea that characters always have to change is outdated. Characters, we don't all change, and we certainly don't have revelationary change. We maybe change in bits and parts, we evolve. And so it always begins with character for me. And from the character, I can sit down at a cafe, as you said, and write the description of a character, and then try to imagine her story or something that might be a story for her. But it always begins for me with, who is she? What's she dealing with?
And I don't know if you find this, but I feel like if the writer figures out what the story is too early on, it can almost ruin it. You know, like if you come up with an idea that's very clever to figure out how to write it, you can really destroy the piece of writing versus finishing it and saying, ah, see what that was about. Although, you know, I do think
writers can overthink things, and I'm not. I know everybody has a different process. There are people who do outlines very successfully. I would never do an outline. I think that restricts the creative process. We all come to it differently, obviously, but I think it's so important to just go with it. And the key question always is, and I ask myself this question every day when I sit down, whatever it is I'm working on, what if? What if, or what might happen now? And that's what begins to drive that character forward into a story. And I think that's what makes it work for me.
Yeah, yeah. Do you use bumps or sort of challenges to yourself? Like, I've got in first, and now I need to try second or third, or only going to write a story with no dialogue, or you know what I mean? Kind of putting parameters around your writing to stimulate something?
No. Mm-mm, I don't. I let the situation or the character drive it. So in a story like A White Writer, it's obviously going to be a largely dialogue-driven story because they're sitting at lunch and they're talking about this issue of race and writing about race. It seems to me it's all about dialogue. And then there's a story in there called The Good Enough Woman, which is a second person telling, oddly. You know, that was very interesting to play with. And for me, that's the only way that story could have been told. And it's almost all prose. There's almost no dialogue.
Yeah.
But because she's, you know, we're in the second person responding to what's going on in her life, there was no place for dialogue. It didn't belong. So I don't ever put parameters ahead of time, but the story seeks its own level, you know?
I liked the style of all your dialogue is in italics as opposed to using quotation marks, which I think you said some literary journal pushed back on that at some point.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, recently. Yeah.
Funny.
Of my readers, I had a series of readers early on, and one of them is actually a screenwriter, but and he doesn't read all that much contemporary fiction. So he said, what's the deal here? What happened to quotation marks? But it's the form is so fluid now. I mean, I read books, I'm sure you do, and stories too, where there's no designation of that it's dialogue at all.
Right.
It's just embedded in the paragraph and you have to get it. And that's sort of interesting because it doesn't distinguish between the prose and dialogue. It brings it all together and you just have to read very carefully.
Right.
I think I got lazy. I think it was easier to do it that way than all those quotation marks. Honestly, I wish there was something more literary to that, but I don't think there is. It just kind of worked, but everybody has to choose for themselves. I think the rules are off.
Yeah. Since we're living through pandemic times, and you mentioned using quotation marks at all, a little shout out to, I don't know if our listeners have read Jose Saramago's Blindness, but it's about a pandemic, and he doesn't use there's no way to distinguish. And so it really mirrors what it would be like. Pandemic causes sort of this white blindness. And it was a really effective way to make the reader feel blind because you can't tell where the voices are, who's coming.
That's right. Anyway, it underscored the story, yes.
It did. Yeah.
Great, great book.
There's a lot of ways to use and play and break the rules that, you know, can sort of serve the form. I think it's fun to do sometimes, but
right, as long as it's not, you know, gimmicky. Because some things are done gimmicky in that way, and maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. But it is interesting to play with the form, and what you said is correct. It's the form needs to underscore the story in some way or fit it in some way. In this case, it's just a differentiation, that's all. It's still dialogue. It's still broken up dialogue. Although some of the stories early on, I had a lot of dialogue embedded in paragraphs because I wanted the reader to feel how rapidly the dialogue was going along. And then when I went into revision at some points, I thought, no, you don't need to do that. Just let's keep it clean. But, you know, as long as everything you do from the point of craft is in service to the story, then it works.
Right. Well, I brought up reading. We can end in the last couple of minutes here on what books either you're reading or you recommend people to read, things that maybe have been sitting on their shelves for years that they've thought about. Somerset Maugham is a great recommendation.
The Razor's Edge. I read it every 5 years. I always see something new in it. I think it's an incredibly overlooked and underrated book. Very early as a sort of existential journey novel, but just beautifully written.
Yeah.
And he convinces you very early on, if we had more time, I'd read Chup from it, because he convinces you really on that somehow he can see through walls and he knows everything that's going on. And he tells you the story and you believe him, even though you know there are scenes which he could not have been present. So how would he know? And yet you believe him. It's beautifully done. I think it's always great to go back to the classics. A lot of people are going back to Virginia Woolf right now, and I'm thinking I'm going to go back to The Lighthouse because I never quite got that book, and I think I need to. But it is a great time to catch up on reading, and I'm always reading something, but I never read more than one book at a time. But oddly enough, I am right now because I'm reading the new Isabel Allende, because she's a lovely writer, and it takes place during the Spanish Civil War. In that period, there was a lot of tumult as well as pandemics. But I'm also reading Vivian Gornick's new book, ironically, because you just asked the question, called Unfinished Business. And she's talking about rereading the classics that she feels molded her literary life. And so she's going back to people like Colette and others. And I'm only in the second chapter or so. But I think it's a great time to go back to stuff that, especially stuff we read really early in our lives that we had to in college or in other places. And now we have such a different perspective. Or I always think it's a good idea to go back to a book that you're not sure you liked, or a writer you're not sure you liked, and try it again.
Yeah.
Because, you might find something really new in it. But the book I want to recommend that everyone should read is by the Nobel Prize winner, whose name I cannot pronounce, Olga Tokarczuk. Tokarczuk. And it's called Drive Your Plow Over the Bones of the Dead. And it's talk about different and extraordinary and literary, and it's not a terribly big book. And she's pretty fabulous, and she just wrote a great piece in the New Yorker about life in the pandemic and how things might change for the world. She is a very big thinker, but also an accessible writer, mostly accessible writer, beautiful writer. So that's a book if people haven't read, it's in paperback and on ebooks, and I recommend.
Yeah, highly. great recommendation.
But also stories. You know, I think this is the best time, actually, to be reading short stories because everyone is so distracted by the news, and there's so much to read on the internet and a lot of good things and important things to be reading on the internet. And so a short story is at the end of the day or first thing in the day is a great way to be transported somewhere else, but not have to commit to a novel if you're just not able to do that right now. So I think short, and there are so many good collections. You know.
Yeah. Do you do any reading in the morning to kind of jumpstart yourself or?
Oh,
I was just wondering if you do any reading first.
Yeah. I try to do some reading early in the day. I will tell you, the New York Times Writers on Writing, actually, that was published for many, many years. Each time was a writer talking about process. And the one I stored in my memory some years ago was Mary Gordon, who happens to be a favorite of mine. And she has this process in the morning where she journals as a private journal and an artistic journal. But then she reads 5 pages of Proust, just 5 pages. And years ago, I thought, oh, this is brilliant, because Proust is just so beautiful. The language is so flowery, and talk about inspiring you. So I made a commitment to do that years ago. And I had a really hard time because I didn't want to give it up after 5 pages. And I said, no, I mean, I need to go on. I need to keep going. And but I do think it's a good idea to read something that has nothing to do with news or practicality. It's not, you know, expository in any way. That's just creative and interesting poetry, short stories. And I try to do some of that, although more often than not, I'm anxious to get to whatever it is I'm writing.
Yeah.
So I break later, and that kind of inspires me a little.
I love it. Randy Kraft, this was a huge pleasure. So we can follow
my pleasure.
You at randycraftwriter.com, great website. And your book is available, out and available everywhere, mostly from independent bookstores.
Can be ordered from bookstores, yes, and Amazon, yeah. I will just want to say one thing to people, that it is Randy Kraft, Randy with a Y, and Kraft with a K, but absolutely no relation to the serial killer of the same name.
I was toying with whether to bring that up. Yeah,
it always comes up. It haunts me ever since I moved to Orange County.
I'm sure it does.
But thank you so much for this. I really appreciate it.